And welcome back to A Businessman's Guide to Almost Everything, the show where I, your host, Cole Brzezinski, get to sit down with interesting people from different areas of the business world, get to pick apart their industries, what make them work, some of the challenges they face. And today, we get to do that with Amanda May. Amanda, would you introduce yourself, where you're from, and what you do?
Sure. I'm Amanda May, and I'm the executive director at the Linden Heritage Museum.
So, Amanda, usually when I'll bring in people like marketers or insurance agents, this is the time where I get to grill them and to try to wrangle out the truth as to why they're ripping us off or something. You're working at a museum. It's a not-for-profit. You're probably not ripping us off.
No.
No. But maybe there are some unpleasant truths about the not-for-profit world right now. So I was hoping to pick apart where those wrinkles might be. So first of all, though, we'll start with an easy one. What are some misconceptions that people might have, whether it's about not-for-profits in general, or maybe more specifically about your museum? What do people not understand?
I think a misconception is that we're slow, which is an odd one if you think about it, because they hope you're busy. But for example, if somebody comes in or I'm trying to get, we're trying to get things accomplished, my new coordinator ran into this while I was gone, actually. We have a lot of people who come in just for the sake of coming in, which is 100% what we want, but it actually leads to what I would call the chat challenge, where people want to come in and they want to talk and they're looking to participate in a conversation. But when you have two people come in and you spend 45 minutes to an hour with them, it doesn't leave a lot of room for productivity. Unpleasant truth is that we really love it when people come in all the time. We also equally don't love it. Not because we don't love them coming in, but because we don't have a lot of employees. So we're trying to get so much stuff done and we really want to talk to them. But oh my gosh, I like haven't gotten to this task for over a week. Unpleasant truth.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But if I was to come in and one of the volunteers there, they're going to enjoy a conversation, surely.
Sure. Oh, yes. All the time. You can stand up front and go find them. Some of them, even if you ask them to walk around with them to show them around, depending on who it was, they'd be happy to do that. That's not a problem at all.
I have actually noticed that when I've come over to your museum in the a few times, there's one particular fella and he starts talking to me as if I've known him for years.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know his name. He's a lovely fella.
What does he look like?
He's the bigger fella, barrel chest.
Oh, Russ.
Russ.
Russ is great. He was also in the Lions Club, lived here for a long time. There's a few of them that are like that. They just want to tell. They just want to talk about the past, which is great where they are.
It's perfect for a museum, really. Yeah,
absolutely.
So how about this? Tell me an uncomfortable truth about funding for museums.
An uncomfortable truth about funding. Ooh. 60% of our budget is just labor.
Wow.
We're almost kind of like retail because employees are what make it happen. And so it's kind of like that ugly, like, oh, it doesn't look good. But on the business side, if you go through the numbers and you look at what we do and how we accomplish it and what we're very diligent to be productive and responsible about what we spend our money on as a nonprofit. So when you actually go down to the nitty gritty and you look at everything that we accomplish and how we manage it, you're like, oh, okay, well, yes, that makes sense. But it seems backwards.
And do you guys have anyone that's full-time on staff?
No, everybody's 32 hours a week or less.
32 hours a week or less.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably including interns then as well, eh?
Yeah. Even less actually. Interns only work 25 hours or less.
Yeah. And that counts for 60% of your budget. That's.
Yeah. It's a odd reconciliation, especially for me coming, doing lots of things, nonprofit, corporate world, salary, hourly, all that. It's, you can justify it if you get into the numbers, 100%. It's very easy to do. You can't justify it if you think of it
right,
like as a stagnant museum. What?
Do Do you find that you have that, like, that question posed to you often? Like, why isn't our money going further with the museum?
Actually, yeah, more often not. But honestly, the simple answer is things are expensive. Materials are expensive. Unless you have great community people, which happens, they do this, who are willing to donate materials. And maybe you have somebody who is generous with their time. And like, if we have an electrical issue or something that we're trying to put together, that they want to come in and spend an hour of their, you know, skilled time working on things, it goes a really long way. That's how, you know, the new bridge here in town kind of got built. People donating their time and their expertise and their planning. And there's a lot of things that happen community wise, but the museum is all year long.
Right.
We need stuff every year, all the time. It's not like a project that happens once a year where we get to kind of like dig in and appease the message and really get people invested. It just doesn't happen that way.
It's probably also not the kind of job where someone can come in and then expect a yearly 4 or 5% raise year on year, eh?
It is my job to make up the difference.
Interesting.
So just like any other manager, supervisor, director, CEO, it is my job to analyze the budget every year, make it. Are we breaking even? Are we going to come in ahead or behind? And wherever I want that increase, I have to either find it or make it happen. So, little bit of a reality check.
Yeah, it's probably not the funnest part of the job.
It's not. If I've done my job correctly and I've planned far enough in advance, like this next year is a little harder, as we know, inflation and like all these other things that are happening right now made it a little bit harder. But because I planned in advance, because I made the right moves in the last couple years, because I talked to the right officials and I, you know, looked at the general path of where things were going, I figured that that would happen. So I managed to build in areas in our business that I could manipulate to still get what I wanted out of the priority items.
So kind of keeping with that, what do you think is going to be the biggest challenge you guys face in 25?
Oh, the biggest challenge will probably actually be something very simple. Like, I don't think we're going to do a temporary exhibit this year. We'll still do all the things that people want to engage with us, but we're gearing up to do a lot of big things that we want to accomplish in 2026. And if I want to make an impact in that year, there are things that I know realistically that I will give up this year. Not to say a temporary exhibit won't happen, but in past years, I go out and I'm actively working on putting things together. This year, if one happens, it pretty much has to fall in our lap.
Can we poke and prod? Like, what can we expect in 26?
So 26 is our 50th. So we're doing things like acknowledging the past with our original board members and who they were as community members and what did they contribute. We had this fundraising thing that was acknowledgement for the first 500 members of the museum. We do not have 500 members at the museum right now. So it's acknowledging those people and how they participated and how far we've come. So that people know that, look at everything that we've done and look at where we are now. And now I would like to explain to you where we want to go, how we want to change, how we want to evolve and all that. But every quarter is kind of a different topic. So every quarter will almost have its own temporary exhibit in some way or another. So the Lions Club, along with the city, refinished a older Dutch windmill that they found that used to belong to somebody local. It is at the museum. It's finished. There's now going to be a history revolved around that. And then we're going to, you know, have another topic or another highlight in the other quarters. So I don't have all the answers right now because that's what we're working on right now. But that's the plan.
It just takes, you know, 6 to 9 months to get each of these things set up, eh?
Well, those will be a little bit more generalized and specific. So they won't take up larger spaces. They'll more be like walking exhibits. Like we might walk through something, or maybe it's something that already exists in the museum, but we'll create a walking tour to specifically engage with that content. Or maybe we like revitalize our downtown Main Street and do something in conjunction with the fact that our own Main Street locally has been revitalized. So it's just kind of connecting those dots of how we've changed, how long it took us to get here, how important it was that our community allowed us. It was, the museum was literally built on donations and volunteer work.
Wow.
We did not get federal funding. The city bought the building, but it's like a giant community effort.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So 50 years, who are some of the key people then that I guess came together to make it happen? Were they just like local businesses, local families?
So the building that we're in used to be North Washington Implement, which was the John Deere tractor dealership. And the size of the building that you see was only half the size. So there used to be like a concrete path to the east where the Main Street exhibit is now. And basically what happened was North Wash moved. That building became vacant, and I cannot remember the owner off the top of my head, but who owned it, but she was local. And she, I think she was a previous owner of North Wash, but Fred Polander III came to the city and said, I have this large horse and carriage collection. And apparently it had been a discussion that leading up to the bicentennial celebration of the city that they talked about putting together a museum to celebrate their past and celebrate their 90th year and all of this kind of stuff. So a couple things happened in the city. Then Cape stepped forward and said, well, talk about buying the building and a collection. And then a gentleman named George Young, who long history in the area, he was in retirement. He came out, carpenter, lots of skills, built all the things that you see in the building with him.
So is
and his family, his brother.
Is he partly responsible then? Because
yes,
for those who don't know about the Linden Museum, the coolest exhibit is what is effectively a miniature town.
Yeah.
And yeah. So
he's 100%. There is, because I'm doing all the research now, his pipe dream was that side of the thing. That side of the building did not exist. They brought in the old trusses from the original Bellingham Ferry Terminal before they did all that stuff. And people donated their trucks and their equipment and their skill sets and their labor and then ultimately money to get that side built. And there are Tribune and Bellingham Herald articles about how that did not exist yet. And ultimately that's his dream, was to recreate.
It's cool. When I grew up, in, I'm not going to say bum country, Ontario, Canada, but
I wondered by the A.
Yeah, it shows every now and then.
Yeah.
But I remember we had a small town museum as well. It was not a super old town, but you know, a couple decades. And farming town. All right, let's go to the farming town museum. Let's see what's going on. And the big thing was that they had, remember Mr. Peanut? The one who's on all those peanut cans?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was their big thing. That they had a life-size, or sorry, extra life-size replica of Mr. Peanut.
Okay.
And they had a whole bunch of junk in the museum. Not well organized, bunch of articles. And as a kid, you kind of got tired of Mr. Peanut. So you would go out to the big exhibit that's behind. And it's a barn that they converted into the extra division of the museum. So we went in there. It's just 12 tractors. Not in good condition, mind you. They're just 12 tractors that they got parked in there.
Yeah.
And so when I heard that the Linden Museum was having a murder mystery night, we're like,
oh, that's right.
Museums don't do that. They're boring and they have Mr. Peanut in them. And then I come out and there's this whole town replica. It's perfect for a murder mystery.
Oh, sure.
And it was a blast.
No murders, by the way. Family friendly.
Family friendly murders only.
Kidnappings and, you know, thefts.
Anyways. Yeah. Yeah, it's a really cool museum that you guys got.
Yeah, if you think of the capacity and to build, you're basically building a house.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some things that I wonder why they chose to do it that way. But structurally, you got, I mean, it's just a feat, and to build everything that's inside of them too is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. And every different building that you have in there is like this own different little snapshot of what life could have been like.
Yeah.
So let's move back a little bit to museums as an industry as a whole.
Yeah.
I've had this conversation with a few other people, and it seems like in the last 5 years specifically, we've seen a lot of mid-size and small businesses get eaten up by the bigger ones, whether that is banking. We saw some bankings collapse during, I think, 22 and 23.
Right.
They got eaten up by the big guys. We're seeing insurance carriers might be facing some of the same challenges with like the Palisade fires, which could be looking at $200 billion worth of damages, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Do you think museums are going to go through a similar challenge where eventually we're going to have these big city museums coming up and they're basically buying out and supporting maybe these smaller town museums?
I don't see buyouts, but I see age outs.
Age out.
So museums, feasibility wise, economically, it doesn't make sense for a museum, for the most part, to come and say, hey, we know you're not succeeding. We could do it better. You're going under. We're going to take what you have. Basically, that probably won't happen, at least from what I've seen.
Right.
But what will happen is interest wanes, funding dries up. Basically, they no longer cease to exist. And that's the hard part about the community development part that's kind of in your face. When you don't have that, that will happen. And they could be trying really hard, but it's that if you don't have, if you're not in tune, if you're not trying to actively seek what they want to be involved in, your audience doesn't want to come in.
I know it's easy to rag on the young generation.
Yeah.
But do you think younger folks right now have the interest to sustain small town museums?
To honestly, they have the benefit of change. If they embrace the fact that we have something unique in like our museum, and they see the potential because of where they are and all the different things, like our museum could be made a whole social media personality. Like just having somebody walk around the museum and into rooms and being like, oh my gosh, look what I found. I mean, you look at what people do these days, the potential is there. But even though I see it personally, I might never get to that point. But if we have somebody who has gone to school for it, has a history background, the benefit to them is actually that they're in the younger generation that has grown up with all that technology, and they're a little bit more comfortable with that part. And so if they can see the potential in manipulating it to be creative with it, there's a museum that we that I follow actually that I found, and they are they have an old printing press just like the one we have, and literally all the most of the videos are literally of just them making prints on their own printing press. And then they're talking about history references in the background.
It's kind of nifty.
It is kind of nifty. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers. Is that not crazy?
That is crazy.
And they're a museum. I mean, the stuff that I see in their stuff is not some is stuff that we have.
It's at such a weird angle, like museum ASMR, because that's what I'm kind of imagining.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Creaking floorboards at night, going through rooms, opening doors, rummaging through stacks of collection items and paperwork, or like paper.
That's funny.
That's a thing.
I know every now and then my wife will show me a video, and it'll be of some like some family that went homesteading. They've given up regular life and they're trying to become Amish or something. Like, isn't this nice? It's like, yeah, it's nice.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I don't know. There is an appetite for that old fashioned kind of slow down.
It's the aesthetic of the sounds and the way it looks, yeah, for sure.
Add a little bit of storytelling.
Yeah. We could totally, I mean, it's 100% possible. It would not be hard to do. There's so much content there. It's not even funny. And the hard part for us that we have struggled with that we're fixing now, I mean, I have 7 interns right now, is we don't know where anything is. We don't know where all the paperwork belongs to. We don't actually know. We know what we have, but we don't know exactly what we have. So from a data aspect, like a data background, I want to be able to say, I want to keyword search. I want to pull up pictures. I want to plan.
Right.
Because of our age and we're a small town museum, it was the papers go in the pull out and you can go look for them upstairs. Right. It's fine. That's just the way it was. So trying to manipulate that a little bit so that the other things are possible is what we're working on.
Yeah, no kidding. So I want to put you on the spot now.
Oh, no.
I want you to make a case for why local museums are critical for the small towns.
Because at some point, your grandpa or your dad are going to be gone. And to be honest, with the way that the museum is set up now, their memories live there. They are relatable. We have people coming from all over the country and they're like, oh my gosh, I had something just like that. We are down to earth, building full of memories, but it's relational to the objects. So yes, we have a lot of stuff, but we have things where you're going to walk through and you're like, oh my gosh, my dad had that press or that saddle or whatever when I was growing up. And then you're going to talk about all that. The other part is that since we are on a path and we're really dedicated to bringing and engaging that new generation, we need to exist so that we can take all of that and grow with them so that it's relatable to them for context. We all know what happens when you don't talk about history. It will repeat itself in one way or another. So if you do not inform them, if you do not give us the opportunity to inform them and then allow us to take on the responsibility of deciding how we want to present it to them, then we are ensuring that most of it will disappear because we're relying on everybody else to always be telling the story. And everybody's lived a life multiple times over. There's so much information. Like, it's incredibly daunting at times if you really think about it.
Right. So counterpoint, why don't we just take all of our museums, consolidate them into big city museums? Fewer infrastructure resources. We can all just go down there. We hear all the same stories, right?
With the growth we've seen, that's basically like saying we're going to put a museum in Seattle. Are you going to drive all the way down to Seattle just to go to the museum? I don't think so.
No.
Relational proximity is important. Doesn't mean we have to be big, but it should be impactful. What type of being impactful is going to make a difference? And that's up to each individual museum to decide how they want to do that.
Do you think, now Linden might be a special case because Linden has such a very specific and a very rich history to it. But do you think, by and large, local communities support their museums enough?
Not enough, but I do think that it's hard for people to understand how. Like, I don't want to come volunteer at the front desk. I don't want to come help you paint walls. It's part of our responsibility to make people understand how they can participate. Sometimes that's just coming to a free open house. Some of times it's saying, hey, you're already out at the parade on June 1st or whenever the Farmer's Day parade is, just come say hi. Or it's to share. You might not want to go, but tell other people that you think might be interested. Or if you are close with another organization, tell them to come see us. There are so many different ways that we can make what we do possible. And it's hard for us to be transparent about all of that. So just managing that part of the relationship.
Do you think one of the ways to help let the community know about the value of these museums is for the museums to change their value proposition, to add something new?
Yes and no. There is something about, like, you can't sacrifice who you are to get something that you think you want. For us, what we really, really would like is to, you know, double our visitor count or whatever the whatever that is, or double our event participation or raise twice as much money. But we can't sacrifice those values. And that's why companies have those values, is to keep them from going off on a path that no longer represents who they are. Should they be evaluated every decade? Probably. We just recently revised our mission statement, more so because now we've been around for almost 50 years and it was too specific, like, of a content. Well, the longer we're around, the more history that technically we need to represent. So let's make sure that we are still explaining that that's what our goal is.
So give us an example with the mission statement. How did those change?
Coming from a business background and strategic planning, you need your mission statement or your vision. Some people use them a little interchangeably, so it's a little bit of an opinion.
Yeah.
Repeatable. So if I can't explain to you right away what my mission is at the museum in two sentences and encompass most of my mission statement, how are you supposed to know what my intent is? Mm-hmm. And that is a lot of the challenge. And so our mission statement and our visions were really long, like good paragraphs long, all great stuff, but we didn't need all of it in there to communicate to people what we're there for. So we just went through a revision period. This was part of our kind of get down and dirty change portion, where we go through strategic planning, we go through mission and vision statements, we go through financials, we go through programs, we go through marketing. We went through everything with like a dream at the end of where we wanted to be at the end of the 5 years.
All right. Well, I think we have time for one more question.
Okay.
So, what do you think the future of museums will look like? And how do you think small town museums can grow in that future?
I think immersive. Take this one with a grain of salt. But when you go to Disneyland or Disney World, you are encompassed by your surroundings. And that is something that museums, I think, can take to their level. Sounds, smells, like things that you feel, touch, look at, but way more immersive. So you walk the downtown Main Street. One of our goals is that you can walk into that room. Maybe you hear clerks talking in the background and you can pick up stuff on the counter and you can smell coffee, old time coffee roasting, or whatever the case may be. Like, you're walking into an experience. There are so many different ways to do that. You don't necessarily need to use technology, but there's some baseline foundational stuff that I think small town museums can incorporate without having to worry about bringing in tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars to accomplish it.
Yeah, because that does sound like the challenge. I'm already imagining like how big of a task it would be to just run all of the kinds of electrical equipment you would need to for all of the sound equipment.
Yeah, depending on what you were doing, it would have to be super baseline. Whether, and you can't do Bluetooth because you got to be able to have people troubleshoot it, which is literally unplug and plug something back in, in the simplest aspect. So you have to, okay, if I want sound there, I got two speakers. I got one in this corner and one in that corner. That's it. That's all. Like, you're talking about basic ambiance background noise.
No, and like that realistically doesn't have to be a huge investment.
No, it has to be planned, because if you don't know or have been in any of that, the price escalates quickly.
Right.
So oh, let's do all our exhibits. Oh, no, no. You might only put two speakers in each one of those, but you might do four. Mm-hmm. You're not going to do all of them.
But you know what? That four makes a difference.
Does. It does make a difference. And then that's where the revolving change part can happen in lieu of, say, a temporary exhibit.
Right.
Instead, we're going to work on enhancing some of the stuff that we have so that they're different when you come in versus a completely different topic that's different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that's good. All right. Well, Amanda, thank you for joining me for this third conversation. Final question. Where can people find you if they're interested in you or the museum?
You can get a hold of me just at the museum. You can come by, say hi. My information is on the website as well.
All right. Linden Heritage Museum. There you go. Thank you, everyone, for coming out again to A Businessman's Guide to Almost Everything. We hope that you enjoy this conversation, and we look forward for you returning when Amanda comes back herself. So until that time, take care and be well. Bye-bye.